I'm already thinking about where we're going next. You know, if I went super fast, which you know I never do, we could actually maybe finish Joseph by Christmas, but I don't think we're going to do that because I don't want to rush it. But I think I know where we're going next. You'll just have to wait till, you know, April to figure out what that is with me. But the last time, yeah, it's a lot of suspense, right? But last time we were together, actually we didn't meet last week, but last time we were together, Sue was covering for me, and just want to thank Sue for doing a great job introducing us to Joseph. I listened to that. It sounds like you guys had a good time and some great discussion. But Sue covered with you the favoritism there in Jacob's family, Israel's family, how Jacob favored Joseph and his brothers were jealous. And we closed up chapter 37 with Joseph being sold down to Egypt by his brothers and becoming a slave to Potiphar, who was some kind of officer of the Pharaoh. We're not sure about that. But the remaining brothers, you know, concealed the truth from Jacob and caused him to think that a wild animal had killed Joseph. So now, you know, Moses is really a great writer. And so now Moses does one of these, meanwhile, back at the ranch type of things. And so as we come into Genesis 38, Moses is shifting the scene for us, and we're going to focus in this chapter on a different son, and that's Judah. Judah, you probably remember, was one of the sons of Leah. He was the fourth son of Jacob, the fourth son of Leah also as well, and his birth was marked by praise instead of bitterness. All the sons that had been born to that point, their mothers, or Leah, gave them names that reflected what was going on in the struggle between Leah and Rachel. But when Judah was born, his mother said, "This time I will praise the Lord." So finally somebody got a good name out of this, and his name means one who is praised. And as we turn the corner into this chapter, Judah's situation, and really the situation of the entire family, is in doubt. At this point, Jacob is probably grooming Joseph for the leadership of the family, because Joseph was the son of his favorite wife, and he was his favorite son also. But now, with Joseph being out of the picture, or at least so everyone thought, who is going to take the lead? Who is going to have the leadership of the clan in the future? We know that Reuben was unstable, right? He couldn't stop, even though he was the firstborn. He couldn't stop the other brothers from selling Joseph, or he didn't care to. And he had also committed incest, so that's kind of disqualifying, right? Simeon and Levi, you remember the story about their little deal there with the men of Shechem. Simeon and Levi turned out to be killers. So you have your first three sons turning out to be very unsavory choices to run the family. So Judah is the next oldest, and there's also the youngest, Benjamin, who might also have been favored because he was also one of Rachel's kids, but Benjamin was still very young at this point. So we don't know what Jacob was thinking, but with the benefit of hindsight, you and I know that God apparently was planning to create a leader out of Judah. And, you know, when God wants to work on us, it can be quite an interesting process that he takes us through. And that was going to be the case in Judah's life. In chapter 37, Judah had perhaps prevented Joseph from dying in the pit by suggesting that he be sold as a slave. And there might have been some mixed motives there, of course. You remember that Judah said, "Well, let's not kill him because there's no profit in killing him." Now, maybe he was just saying that in order to talk tough while still saving Joseph's life, you know, look tough in front of his brothers and sound as hardcore as they were. But Judah also said that they shouldn't lay hands on Joseph because he was their brother and their flesh. So that shows us that there's at least a little glimmer of a conscience there. There's at least a little bit of mercy that shows him to have a little better character than these other men. We have 10 brothers here selling Joseph. 10 is the number of testing. And God tested these 10 brothers, and it would seem that out of these 10 brothers, Judah was the least awful. Is that a thing? He was the least awful brother. But, you know, God always knows what he's doing. So let's see what happened over the next few years to get Judah ready for leadership. So starting in verse 1 of Genesis 38, says, it came to pass at that time that Judah departed from his brothers, and he visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira or Hira. And Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he married her and went in to her. So she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Ur. She conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. And she conceived yet again and bore a son, and called his name Shelah. He was at Kezib when she bore him. So Moses says that Judah left at that time, meaning the time that Joseph was born into slavery. All right, so Joseph gets sold, and Judah says, I'm gone. We don't know why. Could have been guilt, right? Could have been guilt that kept him from looking his father in the eye. That's very plausible, I would think. And the family camp, the encampment, was now probably a strange and a sad place. You know, when you're accustomed to being somewhere, someplace, and something has happened and it's just not the same being there anymore. And maybe Judah was a little more sensitive, and so he just couldn't handle being there anymore. Maybe he had come to hate and resent his older brothers. Maybe he just said, you know what? I am so done with the dysfunction of my crazy family that I just need my own space. I need to do my own thing. So maybe he just wanted a different life and to be away of everything that would remind him of older days. So these guys have a lot of business interests in the region because they're not settled down, but they're always interacting with the people that they're trading with. And so he becomes friends, or he has this friend, a man named Hira. So he's got this social circle now that includes Canaanites, and he does something which was probably really distressing to Jacob if Jacob knew about it, and that's marrying a Canaanite woman. This was something, you know, that the patriarchs had told their kids not to do. You remember we saw when Jacob is leaving the service of his father-in-law, with that episode, the family got cut off from its cousins over there in Mesopotamia. But Judah breaks the pattern. He doesn't do what would have been expected in the family. They usually married inside their extended clan, right? So Judah didn't do that. He didn't go to the Ishmaelites and say, hey, you're my second cousin, I'll marry you, or something like that. He didn't go to the Edomites, who were also cousins to him. So instead, he goes to the really degraded pagans, the Canaanites, and we're not even told the name of his wife. That can't be a good sign, right? When you're reading a story and God doesn't even, like, you know, give this Canaanite woman the time of day to even mention her name, you know that can't be a good sign, and it's probably a reflection on her character. And, you know, his father-in-law's name was given, which is Shua, whose name, that word can actually mean wealthy or prosperous. So that's a little clue that Judah is interested still in the wrong things. So he's either after her because there's money there, or else he's just after her because of her physical beauty, because it says he saw her. He just spotted her and said, I've got to have this woman. So all through this chapter, you're going to see the theme of seeing. What are we seeing, and how are we seeing it? And what Judah sees and what he fails to see is the thing that Moses uses. It's the little theme that Moses uses here in this chapter to show us that this is what's going to determine Judah's growth as a believer and as someone that God is grooming to be the leader in the family. So it first starts out by him seeing this woman and saying to himself, I've got to have this woman, maybe this wealthy woman. So he's separated now. He's probably hoping for a better future for himself as he starts over, and he has these three sons. I don't recommend you naming your kid because, you know, it sounds like you're just stuttering or something. So I don't know. It's kind of, I feel weird every time I'm saying it up here, but Onan and Shelah. So those names mean something like watching is the first one. The second one is strong, and the third one is prayer. So those are good. Those are good names, which means he's hoping for a good future. If the names of those men are any indication of what their destiny is going to be, it's pretty good. If you name your kid Strong, right? So I'm going to give him a good macho name. What could be more not macho than just saying your name is Strong Man, right? So, but that was not to be the case. And Moses, as we've said, always gives us little clues in the names of people and places. So when this last son was born, he gives us the detail that Judah was at this place called Kazib, or Hazib, which means false. Could you imagine living in a town named False? Judah was living a false life. The names of his sons indicated that he wanted a good future for them, but it was based on a false foundation. He had given them a Canaanite mother, and they were living steeped in the degraded world of the Canaanites. So there's a lot of wordplay here and little clues that Moses wants to give us. All right, so moving on now, we're going to see what happened to these sons. Verse 6 says, then Judah took a wife for his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord killed him. That's not a great, you know, biography. Mm-hmm. One sentence. He was wicked and God killed him, right? And Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and marry her and raise up an heir to your brother. But Onan knew that the heir would not be his. And it came to pass when he went into his brother's wife that he emitted on the ground, lest he should give an heir to his brother. And the thing which he did displeased the Lord, therefore he killed him also. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah is grown. For he said, lest he also die like his brothers. And Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. All right. Now, this, you've already figured out that this is one of the stories that we don't read to our kids, right? So, and you're all glad you're not me when we read these stories. But now we meet the important female character in the story here, which is Tamar. We don't know anything about her except that she was likely a Canaanite woman also. Her name means a palm tree. And this is another pun from Moses, because that speaks to us of fruitfulness. But in her case, the name starts out being a reproach against her because she was not obviously fruitful at all. We think that Judah married young. It doesn't always come across in the stories, but you got to remember that there is not much that separates these guys in age. Judah could not have been many years older even than Joseph. So Jacob was over there working for his father-in-law for 20 years. Didn't even start having kids he didn't get married, right, until 7 of those years had gone by. So there's only about 13, 14, 15 years that separate all 12 of these men. So Joseph gets sold down to Egypt when he's 17. Judah maybe is only himself in his early 20s. So it seems that he wanted to marry his sons off very young also. And really, probably what's happening here, we can't be sure, but it seemed like he was in a hurry to grow his family into a people of his own and do it in a hurry, right? Remember, he took off. He said, I'm done with this life and I'm done with you folks. I'm going to go over here, live over here, and kind of make my own tribe become something. But his hopes for his family were about to turn into tragedy. The firstborn is he was wicked, and we're not told what that wickedness was. But it was evidently was something so extreme that Moses even doesn't want to mention it. So it's probably some heinous act or crime that Moses doesn't want to give us the gory details about, because he's just simply said to be wicked, which is a strong word. It's not like, you know, you and I, we stumbled, we had a weak moment and fell into a sin, okay? If Moses said this guy was wicked, that means he was habitually practicing some notorious sin. Maybe he had learned the ways of the Canaanites, which they were always very careful to preach against and want to avoid. His name, here again is the pun, his name meant watching. And the lesson there that Moses was giving people and that parents would give their children when they read this story is that it turns out God was watching, right? Was watching him. And so that's a frightening bit of wordplay there. All right, now we come across this very strange custom, I think one that we find shocking, certainly in our culture, and that is the custom of what we call levirate marriage. That word levirate, it's not Levite, it's levirate, and it comes from the Latin word for brother-in-law. So under this practice, if a man died, his brother-in-law was expected to take his widow to be his own wife, and then he would raise up children for his deceased brother through her. So everybody in the room now is thinking about their own family and going, ew, gross, right? These children would not be counted as the children of the biological father. They would be counted as being the children of the deceased. And this was a custom. This is not some weird thing that Judah came up with, you know, out of a whim. This was a custom that was followed by a number of different cultures in that part of the world, not just the Hebrews. And in most cases, a son-in-law, or a brother, I should say, of the deceased had this duty. In some cultures, even a father-in-law was expected to fulfill that duty. So this practice later shows up in the law of Moses, and it was an obligation in Israel. If you enjoy the book of Ruth, then you know that these customs play a very big role in the story of Ruth. But for the Israelites, it was forbidden for a father-in-law to perform this task. So we can thank God for that anyway. But why was this done? There were a few reasons. First, these were cultures that had a much bigger emphasis on valuing the group, valuing the family, whereas in our culture, we value the individual above everything, right? So these folks valued group identity, and they highly valued the inheritance that they received, because to them, especially later on when God divided out the land to them, that land was directly given to them by God. And so the idea that, or the risk that you might actually lose the land that God himself gave you was a terrible tragedy in Israel. So it was considered a great tragedy if your family line, if your family name was ever extinguished. And so this kind of marriage would keep a man's family line from being wiped out. So it's very strange. So you basically are causing to be born a boy who is not going to be considered your son. He's always going to be considered your nephew, so that your deceased brother's share of the inheritance doesn't get extinguished. Mm-hmm. Second reason they did this was to protect widows. You have to remember that, of course, in ancient times, all the way up to the modern day, there's no social safety net. You know, so Judah doesn't say, well, I'm so sorry, Tamar, I will drive you in my chariot tomorrow to the Social Security office and we'll set something up for you, right? So in these societies, a woman who doesn't have a male protector or a group of male protectors, whether that's physically or economically speaking, is in tremendous danger. And God was always upset in the Old Testament when there were widows and orphans. But of course, I think you can already see the tension here. This was not necessarily something that men wanted to do, because it could be an extra economic burden for men and could probably reduce their future wealth by decreasing their share of the family inheritance. So if you are Onan, you're being asked to raise a son who is going to take your deceased brother's share. Whereas in other societies, he wouldn't even have a share because he's dead. So if you didn't sire, if you want to use that word, that son, that share would have gone to you. So, you know, men a lot of times resisted that because they say, listen, this is a burden on me. You're asking me to make kids who aren't going to be considered my kid. And I also have to support this woman that I don't know or maybe that I don't like. And I have to treat her as my wife. So, not a custom that I think that let's just say neither Trump nor Hillary would have been able to get this passed in the Congress. Okay, so The case of Onan is a very sad case indeed. So he is asked to marry Tamar and raise up seed for his deceased brother. So you understand, right, that because of this custom now, any child that is produced from this marriage is going to be considered to be the son of his deceased evil brother, Ur. So Onan refuses to do this, and Moses tells us, if you couldn't read between the lines there, that he withdrew from Tamar's body as they're having sexual relations. So once again, we could see that the Bible is very frank and honest about human relationships. Now, you'll see his name come up sometimes in connection with a particular sin. It's often been said that the sin of Onan was in pleasuring himself. And so for a lot of years, people used the word Onanism to talk about masturbation. This has nothing to do with that. That was not what God was angry with, and it also has nothing to do with birth control. The sin in this story was actually in his failing to consummate the marriage to Tamar, and so he was considered to be a disgraceful person who violated, who broke his duty to his late brother or his duty to the family, if you will. And so the Lord slew Onan as well. And you remember the story of Ruth, perhaps. So in the law, if you refuse to do this, you could refuse, but they had a ceremony where they would actually take off your shoe, which was a symbol of the fact that you had a right to possess the house. And so you wouldn't be allowed to possess the house. And they would actually like spit in your face and say, this is the disgraced guy who wouldn't raise up his brother's house. And so you were known as that guy. So it wasn't an absolute obligation, but you were looked down upon as an unworthy person who wouldn't do this. So because of what Onan did, the Lord killed him as well. So what's the upshot of this strange story is that Judah sends Tamar away. So as a father-in-law, theoretically, he does have authority over her, but he is not willing to give her the benefits of living under his roof. We don't know what the age difference is between her and this one remaining son, but Judah, even though he says, you know, he's too young to marry you, just go hang out at your father's house, go back to your father's house, he's not going to take care of her unless he's doing so indirectly. So he sends her back until Shelah is grown. The best interpretation we can put on that for Judah's behavior is that he didn't want people to think that he himself was behaving in an inappropriate way by having Tamar living there. But we also don't read that he did anything to help her. So he's basically just not taking care of this woman at all. So her plan to get some help for herself and get some support for herself involves this also very smarmy and uncomfortable deception. So in verse 12, it says, "Now in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died. And Judah was comforted," which means the mourning period had expired and he's now circulating in society again. "And he went up to his sheep shearers at Timnah." So again, all of that is a detail that tells you this guy has bucks. This guy has money. He's well able to take care of Tamar if he wants to. So he goes there, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite, and it was told Tamar saying, "Hey, look, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep." So she took off her widow's garments, covered herself with a veil, and wrapped herself, and sat in an open place. Remember that phrase there, open place, which was on the way to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown, and she was not given to him as a wife. So what's the age difference? We don't know. But you have to know that in this culture, right, women at this age were probably going to be married off not long after they were actually capable of bearing children. So probably most women were married off, if you want to use that phrase, by the time they were 16 or 17 at the latest. So this whole chain of events probably starts when Tamar's like 14 or 15. So when Judah sees her, she saw that Shelah was grown and she was not given to him as a wife. So in verse 15, when Judas saw her, he thought she was a harlot because she had covered her face. Then he turned to her by the way and said, "Please let me come into you," which is, you know, euphemistic language, but still very bold. He just walks up to this woman and says, you know, "Have sex with me." For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. So she said, "What will you give me that you may come into me?" And he said, "I will send a young goat from the flock." So this is good money, a live animal that can feed a lot of people, or maybe it's an animal that's going to grow up and become a productive animal. So this is a lot of money. So she said, "Will you give me a pledge until you send it?" In other words, you know, he's not walking around, you know, carrying a goat everywhere he goes. So she's saying, "I need some kind of a pledge, some kind of a guarantee that you're going to give me this goat." So he says, "What pledge shall I give you?" So she says, "Your signet and cord and your staff that is in your hand." Then he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. So she arose and went away and laid aside her veil and put on the garments of her widowhood. So some time has passed, right? And the unnamed wife has passed away. Tamar comes up with this ruse to act as if she were a prostitute. Why has she done this? It seems like this was, she thought at least, her only way to get any kind of justice, to have something for herself. So she would get a child, at least by her father-in-law, if she could, because maybe that was acceptable to the Canaanites. And then at least in that way, she would have some position in the home. She would be assured of being taken care of economically, because no one has ever called for her to come and be married to the remaining son. So that is her, we would say crazy, but in her disadvantaged situation, maybe that's the least bad ruse she can come up with. That's her response to the injustice that she's experiencing. So Judah comes along and he doesn't know who she is, as you saw. Now this proposal to pay her with a goat, this is a really interesting picture in Genesis, and I don't know if any of you caught it, but in the family of Abraham, as we've been traveling with them through time, you know that there is this recurring idea of deception in the life of the main characters, right? So you have several different episodes where there is a person who is chosen for blessing, right? And then there's a disguise or deception that goes with that. And there's a goat involved also, which is a picture of sin or needing to atone for sin, right? So you remember we have the story of Jacob. Jacob deceives his father Isaac, how? With a garment and with using goat's hair. Interesting, right? Then the 10 brothers of Joseph, they deceive Jacob with what? Joseph's garment that is dipped in the blood of one of the animals of the flock. And now you have Tamar deceiving Judah. So you see, these guys continue to reap what they're sowing in way of deception. Tamar deceives Judah by wearing what? A covering garment, and she is going to receive a goat. So it's really interesting. So Moses is speaking to us all the time about the sin of deception. And if you engage in that, it's going to come back on you. So that would be kind of the hidden message here. But it's interesting that this recurs. So Judah, like I said, he doesn't travel with a goat on his back and a backpack. So he gives her a pledge, and he foolishly gives her a very valuable pledge, really the most valuable things that he has that represent all of his wealth and all of his identity. It's like, "I don't have any cash, but here's my Visa card here and my driver's license," right? You follow me? What is he giving her? See, listen, guys, sin will make you do foolish things. His signet or his seal would have been worn on this cord that was around his neck, and his staff was for walking, obviously, but that seal and that staff were used to do business, and the staff was the symbol of headship, of leadership in the family. It would have had the names of everybody carved on it. So just like you would do business by using your card and your signature, writing a check, they would take the seal, it would have his name on it, they stamp it in wax, and that's how they would conduct business, mark you know, documents or whatever they did. And then the staff, that signifies that he has the right to rule on this family. So if you had a staff like this, it would have been carved. And there might have been additional things carved on the staff relating to the family history. So over time, it would go around the story. So this staff might have had, you know, had been carved on the top, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and then Judah, you know, next in line. And so this is what he gives her. He gives her the most powerful tokens of who he is and what he has the right to do. These are the signs of his headship and his ability to conduct business. So really, this stands for what? All of his wealth and authority? It stands for what? His inheritance. So in a very strange way, he is actually now giving her everything that he was supposed to be giving her in the first place, because she had come under his roof. Isn't that something? So she becomes pregnant as a result of this single encounter, and then she resumes the part of acting the widow. Now, they are meeting in what we could call the place of seeing. And I'm sorry, it doesn't really come through properly in the translation that I typically use in the New King James. But in verse 14, remember I said about this open place. The Hebrew really can indicate that they met in a place called Enayim. And the New King James says an open place, but there are other Bible translations that render that more literally. And what it means is that Tamar sat at the entrance to Enayim. And why does that matter? Because Enayim means judgment in a figurative sense, but in the literal sense, it means your eyes. It's plural for eyes. Literally in Hebrew, the word Enayim means two eyes. So there she is in a veil. He can't see who she is. All he can see is her eyes. And she's sitting at a place which is called two eyes. And I want to suggest to you that this is really the hidden key to the entire story. This is one of those things when I say, because we're not native Hebrew speakers, we miss a lot. All of the important story points here that we're supposed to learn from Moses have to do with what we see and what we recognize, or really what we don't see and what we don't recognize when we're dealing with people and when we're dealing with situations in our lives. So this chapter is about what Judah did not see, and it's about what he saw incorrectly. First, Judah saw things wrong concerning Tamar and about what kind of person she was. I didn't touch on it yet, but if you notice, it seems like he blamed her for the death of his first two sons. He says he didn't give the third son to Tamar because he was afraid that that son was going to die also. Why? Why would he think that? In fact, both of his sons were slain by the Lord, and Judah couldn't see that. He probably was responsible in some measure because he was the one that had allowed them to be steeped in the ways of the Canaanites, and he probably did not raise them to revere the customs of his own people. And so what did he do? He misjudged his daughter-in-law. He judged her as being guilty of the death of his two sons. And second, Judah could not yet see that he was doing an injustice to Tamar by not having her marry the third son, even though he was grown. Time had passed, and he was continuing to do wrong by her, as well as to the rest of the family. And then we have the most obvious reference to eyes, which of course is Tamar veiling herself. And so he couldn't really see or recognize her. But there's more to come. Down in verse 20, Judah says he sent the young goat by the hand of his friend the Adullamite to receive his pledge from the woman's hand, but he didn't find her. Then he asked the men of that place, saying, "Where is the harlot who was openly by the roadside?" Which is not necessarily an insult to her, because he used a different word. Judah used a rough word, which just means prostitute. He used a word that was more respectful for them, because they had women who served as prostitutes out of devotion to the gods. So talk about not honoring women. But that was the word that the Canaanite friend used. And they said, well, there's nobody like that here. There is no harlot in this place. So he returned to Judah and said, I can't find her. Also, the men of the place said there was no harlot in this place. So then Judah said, let her take them for herself, lest we be ashamed. For I sent this young goat and you haven't found her. And it came to pass about 3 months after that Judah was told, saying, hey, Tamar, your daughter-in-law has played the harlot. Furthermore, she is with child by harlotry. So Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. Wow. So Judah, whether out of busyness or embarrassment, sends his friend on this errand to pay his prostitution debt, but Tamar cannot be found. And Judah is just willing to let go of the most important personal items that he carries on him every day, his marks of power and authority. So listen, it is incredible how low people will sink because of sin. All he cared about was not losing face in the eyes of these people and be, let her keep them. Imagine. So he was more concerned about being a little bit embarrassed in public than he was concerned about anything else that had gone on up to this point. So now we notice another form of seeing wrongly or misjudging. Notice that Judah has this religious spirit of judgment. He's a prime example, one of the first examples in the Bible of how having sin in our own lives, and obviously he had some kind of a lust problem here, that made him hypocritical and judgmental of others. Guilt drives us to be harsh with other people. This was the same reaction, right? If you remember the story of King David and Bathsheba, this was the reaction of King David also when the prophet Nathan came to him and told him this parable about the man who stole a little pet, you know, baby lamb. And because of his own guilt, which was obviously considerable, David committed murder. David tells Nathan, hey, the man that would do something like that should be put to death, which is ridiculous, right? So now Judah, when he hears this, he wants to burn Tamar, which is a very harsh penalty. They typically, I mean, you seldom see that, almost never appears in the law of Moses. To burn someone to death rather than stone them was considered like you were just showing an incredible disgrace and defilement to the person by treating them that way. So this is about the worst thing that he could think of to do to this woman in this circumstance. So when she was brought out, so he's obviously friends with the Canaanites. He can exercise enough control by saying, hey, this is my daughter-in-law, that he can get a bunch of Canaanite men to drag her out. When she was brought out, she sent to her father-in-law saying, by the man to whom these belong, I am with child. And then the crowd goes, oh, right? And she said, please determine who these are, the signet and cord and staff. So Judah acknowledged them and said, she has been more righteous than I, because I did not give her to Shelah, my son. And he never knew her again, meaning, you know, didn't have sexual relations with her again. So here it is again. Did you catch it? There's more seeing and more recognizing. Judah is forced to recognize that the pledged items belong to him. The translation for the sake of good writing is using different words here. So the translation here uses the word determine, but in Hebrew it means to discern or recognize. And they're using the same word all the way throughout. This is the same word in Hebrew that is used when Isaac failed to recognize that he was dealing with Jacob, who wasn't really hairy. And it's the same word that's used when Jacob recognized the bloody fabric belonged to the coat of Joseph. So now Moses is using the same word again, and he says that Judah acknowledged them. He recognized them, and it's the same word in Hebrew. So what is happening here, I think is that this is God's way of telling us that the chain of deception here has been broken, has been cut off. This was a generational thing that kept going on and going on. And the more important thing that's happening in the immediate story for, let's say, the growth of Judah's character is that he is also recognizing same word, that Tamar has been more righteous than he. So it seems interesting. You know, sometimes there's people in our lives that they are more concerned for our welfare than we are ourselves. Do you know what I'm talking about? Here's a woman, Tamar, who was more zealous for Judah's family than he was. She was more interested in getting these promises of Abraham of blessing, I think, than Judah was. He, on the other hand, has neglected his duty to her and to his son, and so he recognizes that he has not been as righteous as her. This is a powerful step in the development of Judah's character, even though the story, the background, is a complete mess. You couldn't make a movie based on this and put it on TV, right? Because people would be like, what is this mess? What is wrong with these people? Who would go to see such a horrible movie? But see, what's important here is he has come to the place where he can recognize his wrongdoing. And this is the first time that we see any humility of this kind on the part of any of these brothers. Because they all have a terrible, deceptive, and evil, vindictive spirit that will self-righteously defend itself, right? You remember when the brothers killed the men of Shechem, their attitude was basically what? Hey, they had it coming, right? When you know, Jacob says to them, what have you done? You've made my name to stink among these people. And they're like, hey, they can't do my sister like that. They had it coming. They raped her, so we killed the whole city, basically. This is the first time that any of these people shows a capacity, I don't mean any of the people, any of these brothers, shows a capacity for real spiritual growth. Later on, when we get into the story of Joseph, which we jump into in the next chapters, we're going to see that Judah eventually grows to the point where we can see that he actually has developed a noble character. He not only can recognize his own wrongdoing, but he truly becomes a noble figure. And it's for that reason, traditionally, that people have said that Judah was chosen. This really established the choice of Judah to take the headship of the family, and he would, of course, end up producing the main line of the kings for the people of Israel. Even the Messiah comes from Judah. But it started there with this guy that was really, he was really a mess. He was selfish. He was lustful. But he got to the point where somehow God was able to get through to say, you know what? I have not been a good father. I have not been a good father-in-law to this woman. And that was the beginning of his journey back. So wrap up the chapter. We've got some more twins coming. Verse 27. Now it came to pass at the time for giving birth that behold, twins were in her womb. So always there's twins in Genesis, right? And it's a sign of God's blessing, God giving grace, God giving extra blessing, even when we think that the recipients don't really quite deserve it. So it was when she was giving birth that the one put out his hand, and the midwife took a scarlet thread and bound it on his hand, saying, this one came out first. So we always have to mark who's the first, right? But then it happened, as he drew back his hand, that his brother came out unexpectedly. In other words, the whole baby. And she said, how did you break through? This breach be upon you. So in other words, you did this. You kind of made this opening. Therefore, his name was called Perez, which means breach. Afterward, his brother came out who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was called Zerah. So that means dawning or shining. And because he was the one who kind of dawned first there. And both of these men would become the ancestors of many illustrious people from the tribe of Judah. So once again, you have the story of twins. God loves to give extra blessing. And God is always in the habit, it seems, when he wants to get his point across, of choosing the one who is second. Choosing the one who is not expected to be chosen if we were just strictly following custom. Why does he do that? Well, that's his business. He always wants to show us that it's about his choice, not about our own strength, not about what we can accomplish. God loves to choose the unlikely ones and work on them and elevate them. So, but you look how merciful God is in this story after all this mess. And listen, this is a case, this woman, you know, conspired to basically get what she thought was justice for herself. She conspires to commit incest with her father-in-law, and God, just out of his mercy and kindness, gives her twins. And you see how merciful God is, right? Here's Levi, who's guilty of murder, and his line becomes the priests. Judah is guilty of incest with Tamar, right, in a sense, and gives rise to the kings. So an interesting interlude that lets us know what Joseph is experiencing during his years of obscurity and his years of confinement in Egypt. But it's a necessary interlude because it lets us know that we always focus on Joseph and what God's doing in him. But you know what? While God's working in you, God hasn't forgotten about your family and the rest of the people that you care about. God is always able to work on multiple things and situations and multiple people at once. So God's care was for the whole family. So while God was training up Joseph to be someone who was the leader really of the world, or that part, entire part of the world, God was also raising up spiritual leadership in the family so that they would be ready for even what was to come after that, which is just truly astounding to me, how God can work in so many ways and levels at once. So maybe the moral, if you want to be a wise guy, maybe you might think the moral of the story is, if you want to grow spiritually, you need to get away from your crazy relatives for a while. But there could be some truth to that. So that's the little meanwhile back at the ranch story that Moses gives us. And in the following, once we get into the following chapters, from here to the rest, to the end of Genesis, it's all about what's happening with Joseph in Egypt and how that affects Egypt and how that affects the family that's back up in Canaan. So it all becomes pretty much all about Joseph from this point forward. So
2 weeks ago that we were discussing, we first got into this, Judah, who sold Joseph into slavery, right? When he said, I'm out of here, I'm not doing this anymore. And if you think about what Pontius Pilate did with Christ, washing his hands, isn't that about the same?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it may be that it was guilt, you know, that was driving Judah to get away. Yeah. Because in that situation, you know, we're always focusing on Joseph, right? But I mean, imagine you're these guys and you've got to go and you've got to look in the face of your elderly father and maintain that deception straight into your father's face every single day. And maybe Judah just, maybe he just couldn't do that. Maybe that was just eating him alive. And he just had to get out of there. Was the only way he could deal with it, because that's one of the most rotten things that's recorded in Scripture. So, all right. So, again, God doesn't put these things in stories because he approves of them, but because they happened. So, but any questions or comments on any of that? How many of you are glad you didn't live back then?
That's
right. Ladies, you glad that you didn't live in those cultures? So,
well, my luck, I would have probably been a slave anyway. So,
I'm looking at it naturally.
I just can't believe prostitutes slept in bed for goats. I just can't. Like, I just think about like a sugar daddy. Like, that's just not happening. Sleeping with somebody for a goat. But
well, it could be sold for money. So, you know, shepherds and herdsmen had more wealth on the foot than they had, you know, cash. I mean, people who just dealt in cash were a feature of the cities, and cities were few and far between, and they weren't very big. So it was easier for them to, I'm sure she could have sold that and converted that to some silver, but, you know.
Yeah.
But, It's a shocking story in many ways. So it's amazing as you read these stories. There's a spiritual lesson there, but the overarching thing sometimes is we're supposed to marvel at the grace of God shaking our heads at how good he is to messed up people. Yeah, there's a storyline to follow, but a big thing that covers all of that. I mean, we're all descended from one guy named Noah, you know, who the first thing he does after God uses him to save the world is plop down on his sitting parts and gets drunk out of his mind. So they doesn't even know what's going on. So we're all descended from people who messed up, who didn't know what to do, who didn't know how to handle what life was throwing at them. And that's designed to give us comfort too, because, you know, it's the power of God's covenant that God has committed himself to take care of these people and get them from A to B in life. And then when it's time for them to pass on the baton, he's going to be just as good and faithful to their kids in the following generation and so on. So, you know, yes, the stories are crazy, but God is always behind these poor people, adjusting them and straightening them out and developing their character at the same time that he's protecting them from their own lies and lust and craziness. So the hero in any of these stories really is God. So you say, well, Jesus Christ, the Lord, the Messiah, is descended from this story of Judah and Tamar. That is astounding. You know, Jesus has the blood of this Canaanite woman. You know, it's got her DNA out of this crazy story. So that astonishes me, and that says, well, look, there's hope for grace in all of us. You know, Moses says, now listen, this never happened again. This is bad. Don't try this at home, but this is what happened, and God brought something good out of it. Don't take this as your example, but look how good God is. And I think that's a good thing to reflect on when we come across a story that's really pretty crazy like this. So
this chapter has been confusing to me. Like, I'm very lost in it, but I don't understand where God's mercy and wrath kind of flow in this. Like, why choose to kill and why choose to save these people, kill these people, no matter how Moses wanted to leave out what the wicked was in these people. Throughout the Bible, wicked is what it, you know, it's in black and white. I mean, it's not really hidden much. So in this particular chapter,
we don't know, except listen, that's a really bad neighborhood, right? So that could have been among the Canaanites. That could have been anything. That could have been human sacrifices. That could have been all kinds of horrible things that, you know, that we just don't need to go there, right? I mean, you know, Paul says in the New Testament, you know, it is a shameful thing to speak, even to speak about the things that they do in secret. So, I mean, I just have to think that it was on that level. I mean, he had no problem telling us the story of, you know, why he killed the second son. So I have to imagine that whatever this first son did, it was probably really bad. He probably had plunged knee deep into the really evil Canaanite world, and they were bad. I mean, when they started, the archaeologists, like in the 1920s, the British archaeologists and all these guys started digging up these things, digging up the Canaanite places and digging up the Carthaginian places in Africa who were like the descendants of the Canaanites. They wouldn't even publish it. They probably make a movie out of it nowadays. But in the 1920s, they wouldn't even publish for regular people what they had uncovered and translated, because it was so horrible to them that they wouldn't even tell you what these people did. That's how bad they were. So, it's just...
So do you think Judah didn't want his third son to die because he saw the two others?
Yeah. Well, he pinned it on her, exactly. He said, you know, I'm not going to do that, you know, lest he die also. So he, who knows, he's got it in his mind that, you know, this woman's cursed, she's bad luck or whatever. I'm just not going to send him her way, right? So that's exactly what it says, lest he die also. So he, in his mind, there's something wrong with her that is making my sons die, which is quite a bad thing to tag on somebody, you know. It's like, look, you marry me off to your evil first son that God has to personally come down and kill because he's so bad. And it's like, how is that on me? She's saying, you know, so, yeah.
So that's why he feels justified in not taking care of her.
Well, that's true. That's a good point. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah. He might have said, well, I'll just send you a couple shekels from time to time, but I don't want you around here because you're a cursed woman. Look, I've got, you know, you're like, you know, a black widow here, you know.
Yeah.
You're just wiping out these men one by one. So, yeah, that could very well have been the case.
But she seems to still be taking an incredible risk in what she does. Like, even if she has these things, you could think, like, somehow they'd find a way to get rid of her anyway.
Well, you mean in terms by
well,
behaving
I mean,
that way, by engaging in prostitution?
That, you know, she has his ring and everything. You would think somehow his family would be like, well, we can still cover that up. We can still get rid of her.
Yeah, you have to wonder. I mean, but you know, these people lived very separate lives between men and women. I mean, right? So. One question which nobody asked, and maybe some of you are thinking, is how come he doesn't know who she is? It might not have been unusual in that culture for her even to, oh, and this is what the rabbis thought, that she even would wear the veil all the time in her father-in-law's house as a sign of modesty. So,
Pastor, you're going to have to excuse me. I have to go.
Yeah. Have a good
Everyone
night.
Have a good evening.
You too.
Right. So, you know, Judah might not really have known too well what she even looked like. Right? Like, here's my daughter. She's all covered up. We have a wedding. Hooray. And, you know, nobody really knows what she looks like except her husband. So he might not have really recognized her. And she's probably grown. So if she went from being 15 to being 24, that's a change. So, you know, who knows? But it's just a very strange story that's very troubling on a lot of levels because people want to say, well, who's the hero of this story? Well, maybe there isn't one. This is like a modern movie. There doesn't have to be a hero. It's just something that happened, and you are supposed to learn something from it, or at least you see this guy starting to come to his senses.
I think looking at the fate of the second son, it kind of parallels what happened in the New Testament when, who were they? The folks that were saying they were giving to the church and they kept the money.
Ananias and Sapphira, yeah.
So it's almost like the same thing. Oh, I'm doing an honorable thing being, you know, taking this woman on.
Yeah.
And, you know, you think of, you know, who was trying to deceive even mm-hmm. God, you know, mm-hmm. like doing that in front of God, and God would have none of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So that's the way I see that. It's almost like a parallel.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Yep. There are similarities there to be sure. So. Yeah, and his name, you know, that's kind of embarrassing to have your name come down through history for that, but that his name has been used for that incorrectly, but. I'm just very glad we don't have that custom, so. Just interesting. So, all right, well, I hope that everybody, if you haven't gotten a chance yet to read that book that we were reading over the summer, you know, try to get a copy of that, because it's just really such a wonderful little book, God Meant It for Good, by R.T. Kendall. Just read that. It's not expensive. It's probably like $8. And I just kind of give up underlining or highlighting because you got to highlight everything the guy says. You gave up? It's like, what's the point? Actually, I should send around. There is a link to him that you can watch on YouTube of him preaching the sermon that comes out of that, I think. It's called Total Forgiveness. Or I'll put a link up to it somewhere, at least to the audio. It's really worth listening to. It's about Joseph and obviously in his growth and how he came to that point. You know, God meant it for good. So I'll try to put that out there.
I think Donald Trump should read it.
All right, we're not going there tonight. This is what happens when you turn off the recording 1 second too late. All right, well, thank you guys. Have a good night.